That's me to start, which I think is unfair. I have a quote from a meeting on Friday morning with a few of the guys in the audience. Go to, I just thought it was a great quote. Alcoholics, at our best, we are the elite of the mentally ill.
Read that again.
Alcoholics, at our best, we are the elite of the mentally ill. And the other quote I just love, it said, the monkey is off my back, but the circus is still in town. I mean, where else would you go to get those kind of pithy, you know, sorts of things? I started, I don't really know where to go to this. Andy and I didn't exactly have a path, but we were talking about the solution, and we intend to kind of end up with something that is more specifically spiritual. So what I'm going to talk about and see if Sandy wants to relate to it is what I started to talk about was problems in sobriety a little bit. That I said that many of us, when we first come in, get a real burst of energy, really like what we hear, get kind of on a honeymoon. We make a great, you know, growth period for the first, you know, 2 or 3 years. And by the way, these are obviously generalizations. I'm going to talk about people getting in trouble at 5, 6, 7, 8 years, and not everybody gets in trouble at 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years. These are just kind of, but I'm saying, I believe what I'm saying in general, patterns that are fairly common. And Bill talks about some of this stuff in the big book. But when we talk about, you know, when he talks about, you know, now you've been sober long enough where you know that, you know, all your problems haven't been removed. You know, you've got problems other than alcohol, and that we're going to be doing these spiritual practices over our lifetime. But most of us kind of get on a plateau. So let's just say we go, you know, we've made great progress through the first 2 or 3 years. Is that for me? And then what happens is you start running into, what happened to me is I started having problems I didn't think I should have. I'm an idealist. I came in and you told me that you had an answer for alcoholism. You told me that the unmanageability of my life was a result of my alcoholism, and alcoholism was physical but also mental and spiritual. If I took the principles of the steps, applied them to my life and changed, I then thought, well, ipso facto, I can get rid of the problems in my life. All my life, it seemed to me that everybody was telling me, Bob, you're fairly well equipped to live life. And I could do it for short spurts. If life was a sprint, I had moments of brilliance interrupted by long periods of mediocrity and failure. And but I only looked at the moments of brilliance. People always said to me, you know, you're well equipped. And I thought, yeah, so if I got rid of the problems, I could get back on top and, you know, I'll start doing it. Well, I get sober. I think all my problems are going to get solved. They come up. I start working on them, and they don't get solved. One by one, I had a interesting issue. I went to a psychologist not too long ago with one of my sons working on a father-son issue. And in that thing, he said, I work with a lot of upper middle class kids. And he said, one of the biggest problems I have is the problem they have leaving home. That they leave home, they're used to the family level of living, and they leave home and they go down about 6 stories. You know, that's in our society today, there's going to be lots of kids that aren't going to do as well as their parents. And boy, did I identify with that when I left home. I mean, this idea of now I have to buy toothpaste. You know, or, you know, I mean, gas, you know, I mean, gas was what I charged to my father. I mean, I was so spoiled. And so I was real immature. I came in when I was 23 years old. I didn't really learn how to work till I was 30. And I had a level of fear that I didn't even identify. So I had problems getting up in the morning. I had problems managing my money. I had gambling problems. I had anger issues as a father, and those sorts of things. One by one, they'd kind of come at me. And I'd try to take them on. And I was singularly unsuccessful at managing, at getting rid of my defects of character in my early sobriety. And at first, I thought, oh, I'm just not doing this right. I'll just jack it up a little bit. And I'm going to 5 meetings a week. I'm sponsored. I sponsor people. I'm starting to give talks. I do jail stuff. I'm doing institutional stuff. And I'm thinking, oh, this is just timing. I'll get it. You know, well, I didn't get it. Well, I can tell you, by my 4th or 5th or 6th year of sobriety, when you still don't know how to work. You get an idea that something's wrong. You know, that you don't have a pass. You know, you're really going to have to get this thing handled. And if you don't get it handled, you're not going to have a very good life. And I didn't have an answer. And what happened to me is I got more and more scared. And I kind of thought maybe this is just another deal where I do a great start and poor finish. You know, I've done that one a lot. Now I'm going to do it in AA. You know, it works for other people. It doesn't work for me. And I really believe without hesitation that it worked for you. Now, what I lost the belief in, believe it or not, was step two. I went back, so out of desperation, when my pants caught on fire at between seven and eight years of sobriety, I'm thinking about suicide, really thinking about suicide, not just sort of thing. I'm not thinking about drinking, but I'm thinking about, you know, I don't want to go through this cycle again. And the answer was, you know, Sandy and I have been exposed to some of the great teachers in AA. And I've, in my home group, I mean, one of them for me, one of my great teachers is Warren. And there are other models for me. And those people all had a level of spirituality that I did not have. But the problem that I have with spirituality is if I was going to develop spirituality, I'm going to develop a relationship with God, right? Well, if you develop a relationship with God, you do not have to be a rocket scientist to figure out he's going to want you to get rid of your subscription to Penthouse. You know, I think. I'm not positive. Or stop your gambling habit that's 4 or 5 hours a day. You know, and maybe get on a budget. Maybe, you know, not stop spending 500 more bucks a month than you make. And, you know, stop being angry or violent with your children. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that you've got 3 or 4 patterns of behavior in your life that are probably going to get right on the line as soon as you open up the relationship. So I thought, what the hell is the use of... I've been trying to change those things for 6 years. What the hell is the use of developing a relationship with God if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? So as soon as I clean my act up, I'll go put my application in. but putting it in ahead of time, it just isn't going to work. And I was stuck in that place for 2.5 years. And finally, out of desperation, I went back to the steps. Step one, real easy. You know what I was missing? Step two. I lost step two. I believed it for us, but not for me. You know, I mean, crazy. I believed it. Without question, I believed it for us. I could tell you that this program of restorative sanity, when in fact, I was living my life with a level of unmanageability, and I didn't believe it for me, and I had to regain that. And out of the pain, now, pain, the touchstone of spiritual growth in Alcoholics Anonymous, pain got me to a second surrender. And my ego got suppressed enough that I finally got to a point and said, okay, it's all got to get up on the table. Let's put it on the table. I'll put anything on the table. I'll put my marriage on the table. I'll put my business on the table. I'll put it all on the table. And I started to look around. And, of course, when I extricated my head from my backside, I made a discovery is that there were people in my own meeting with bigger problems than I had with smiles on their faces resolving those problems with the steps. And I came to believe again that God was going to restore me, not us, me, even though us, to sanity. I did a third step on my knee with my sponsor in his office, and I went through and I did a fourth and fifth step. And after I did the fourth, that was my third, fourth, and fifth step. I'm 7 years sober at this time. And after I did that, I had a relapse into my defects of character of some significance one day where, you know, where I went to work late, left early, got in a backgammon game, won $600, came home, got in a fight with my wife, and slapped one of the kids. One of those days you'd like to have it videoed and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years of sobriety can do. And I said, gee, it happened again. And I'm saying, well, weren't you there? I'm saying, yeah, but it was so habitual, it's like I'm in a blackout. So I'm like out of relationship to my own life. I mean, that's how nuts it is, okay? And what I realized in that moment of truth, when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I took step one, I was stripped down and I stood naked in front of my alcoholism. At 8 years of sobriety, I was stripped and stood naked in front of me. Out of the unmanageability of my life, out of the powerlessness of my life sober. And I realized that I couldn't do it. That on my own resources, I was insufficient to the process. And then I got a second thought I hadn't had in a hell of a long time. You are right where you're supposed to be. And I was allowed to take the sixth and the seventh step, which I had not taken at depth until I was 8 years sober. You know, I was trying to get rid of my defects of character. I don't have the power to get rid of my defects of character. And in that surrender moment, okay, I took the sixth and the seventh step, and four of the major problems I was dealing with in my life disappeared that night. Okay, now I had to put supports in. I talked to my sponsor and made appointments about when I'd go to work and how long I'd stay at work. I gave my wife the checkbook. I stopped gambling that night. So I had to do things that would help support that decision, which I often had not done in the past. So this pattern where fairly serious crap going on fairly long into sobriety, while it's an unattractive pattern and one that I'm not trying to advertise, I think it is not uncommon. I think it is that many of us end up in a plateau in early middle sobriety where we have fairly serious... I think our alcoholism goes underground. The physical part gets cured, and the alcoholism starts to express itself in compulsive and obsessive behavior in some other area of our life, sexually, eating, money, you know, whatever, wherever the hell it comes out. I was a generalist. I had two or three. There are some people who... some people specialize, you know, they just have one. And... but I don't, very few people are exempt from what I just described. And that the pattern of your alcoholism goes underground and continues to express itself in your sobriety, in your life. And I'll tell you something. Those patterns of compulsion in my life, it was like drinking. It was like being on dry drunks. I had blackout-like moments. I was hiding stuff. I had patterns of behavior that were very familiar to me in my sobriety. And but when I went in order through the steps and got to step six and seven and had started to have a second spiritual surrender. But the only reason I had that surrender, I think, is because I went through the steps. The only reason I was able to do six and seven at that depth is I had the first five alive and well at that moment. And I was in as much pain. And I told Warren, I said, I feel like I'm dying of thirst lying next to a lake. I said, I can pass the test. I know what to do. I just can't do it. I know what to do. I'm not doing it. And I'll tell you something. I think that a lot of us, when I said we are not under-equipped, I see people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I think are enormously talented people and whose lives do not seem to reflect that talent. And if I were to put it two places, one is I would say it's a type of, when you have unresolved problems, they are like miniature black holes. They suck the joy out of your life. They just drain you of energy that you need to live your life. And I think it's the irresolution of those things that drain us of that spirit that Sandy was talking about. When he said, I get to share the spirit. Well, he gets to share it because he's open. His pipe's unclogged. Okay? But I think, you know, certainly at 7 years of sobriety, I had a little log jam in front of my pipe. There was no spirit coming out. There was a little pus leaking out the end of the pipe, but there was no great spirit, you know, coming out of it. And so what I want to say is I don't think that's as unusual as I thought it was unusual. I thought it was dirty. I was ashamed, and I did not want to share it. My sponsor knew about 60% of what was going on. I know that over here you tell 100%, and I think that's terrific that you that you do that. I was only telling myself 60%, by the way. So that's why my sponsor only had 60% of it. I wasn't strong enough to give myself the right truths and the level of honesty. Okay, but when I put it all on the line, and I, you know, what happens to you is you die. What do you got to do? All you got to do is die and change everything. Other than that, there's not much left to do. But you know, I know that one of the things that holds us back from really in a open and willing way, offering ourselves to the God of our understanding, is we think we're going to disappear. I mean, you take away my defects of character and you take away, you know, some of those things in my life, where am I in that process? Okay, well, I'll tell you something. You're going to be more there than you have ever been in a real and substantial way. You're going to have a chance to be in your life in a more powerful way than you've ever been. It is the opposite because you have now freed yourself of what's been holding you back. you have had, you know, all these layers of crud. You know, all these years you thought you were the Chevrolet. You've been putting new tires on it. You've been putting new hubcaps on it. You've had that son of a bitch painted 8 times. You've got, you know, you're dragging up and down. You're the driver. And you've paid almost no attention to the driver. And so when we get out of the external solution, when we get out of painting the car and putting new hubcaps on, when we get out of it, as soon as I get the next 50 grand, as soon as I get the next this, as soon as I get the right woman or man, as soon as I get a new breast job, as soon as I get, I happen to have a very good one, and you probably haven't noticed, but most of us, without even realizing it, are externally oriented. We're looking outside of ourselves for the answer. And we don't expect, and it's just the opposite. It is just when you find, when you start to find the answer inside is when you're really going to start expressing your life. So what I want to say is that I don't think it's uncommon to get stuck. I think the nature of spiritual walk, what do they always say, the greatest temptation once you have found God is to be tempted with the removal of God. The dry periods are the toughest periods of time you will have. Maintaining a lifetime relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous is not easy. Maintaining a lifetime relationship with your sponsor is not easy, or a spouse. That is what life is about. It will put you in front of you. Long-term relationships will put you in front of the unworkability of your life. If you are going to be a 40-year member of AA, you're going to have to resolve relationship issues and life issues of some significance quite a number of times to remain vital, active, and important. And keep your program alive. So the unworkability is not uncommon. There is a solution, even though it looks like it's proving to you in the middle of your sobriety that it doesn't work. It is the opposite. What I found in retrospect, what was happening to me is that my nose was being pushed in something more real. That there was a pile of manure, that my nose was being pushed in it, and I was, rather than my life getting worse, I was simply seeing it as it was. I did not see it as it was at 1 year of sobriety. I did not see the causes and conditions. I did not see the level of unmanageability. And through the work and the steps, it was like God's hand was at my back, pushing me a little bit closer to the reality of my life. And it felt like it was going backwards. It was the opposite. It was going forwards. I was moving towards what was in my way. And I think a spiritual journey... And when you know what? What's in your way is an illusion. The path of spiritual growth is through the fire, not around it. The fire is an illusion. Everyone in this room knows that when they changed a significant piece of unworkability in their life, it produced energy, not pain. It was an experience of joy, not pain. And why we resist, because we think we're giving something up and it's painful when we get close to seeing the truth. So I think... our walk in Alcoholics Anonymous is that walk. And we're going to run into periods where it's going to be easier than other periods, and we're going to run into periods where it seems like it doesn't work, and that's the nature of spiritual, that's the nature of a spiritual journey. And
brilliant. Thanks, Bob. I enjoyed that immensely. What I want to talk about is going back to basics. But before I forget it, because I get these ideas that go in my head, I want to just make an aside about a phrase that we hear that I've been thinking about lately. Things happening in God's time. Has anybody ever heard that thing? Well, it's just happening in God's time. And this is what I think about that. I think that's crazy. Let's say that you haven't had a job in a while, and you're running out of money, and you're panicking over it. You're freaking out. You can't sleep. I mean, it's just got you. So you go to your higher power. And you decide to pray about it. And you pray, God, please find me a job. please help me find a job so that I can systematically save a little bit out of my paycheck and allow this money to build up so that it'll take away this terrible panic that I have over this situation. The prayer is asking for something that takes a long time. We just prayed that our problem be solved in about a year. Instead of saying, God, could you please remove my fear over my situation now? And we get it now. So in other words, the time frame that we established is what we got. And then we blame it on God. Well, it's just happening in God's time. Well, no, that's exactly what you asked for. So I'd like a job, and then I'd save up the money, and then I'll do that. And then, because in our own mind, we think we see a solution, which is an intellectual solution instead of a spiritual solution. The spiritual solution is the closeness to the higher power where there are no problems. You see, they just get lifted out. When it's lifted out and the fear is gone, your creativity rushes back and you suddenly dream up a perfect place to go look for a job that you wouldn't have been able to think of while you're in a panic state. I mean, it is so funny. So I'm throwing that out. Now, I'm sure there is such a thing as God's time, but I'm saying a lot of times we set the stage for something that's going to unfold over a long period of time, and we're impatient. Well, we're getting exactly what we asked for. And so I just throw that out as something. Now, the thing about the basics, there was a story about people visiting a friend of theirs in the hospital who was in an oxygen tent. And they're carrying on a conversation through the plastic. You know, how's it going, Joe? Oh, doing good. I'm feeling good. Yeah, it looks like I might be getting out in a couple days in there. Hey, can I get you something? No, I'm fine. Well, go help yourself to a banana. And they're having this thing. And when the guy comes back with the banana, he's eating it, he steps on the oxygen hose. And as they're visiting, Joe is displaying some symptoms of not doing too well. He's getting a shortness of breath, and it's, you know, so they buzz the nurse, and she comes in and goes, oh, my God, maybe it's his heart. Maybe let's take his blood pressure. And they're thinking, maybe we got to get him some insulin. I don't know. Get the doctor. Have you done his medication? And then somebody looks and goes, you're stepping on his oxygen hose. They step off and everything straightened out. But for a while, there was a complete misdiagnosis of the situation. And I think that we can easily misdiagnose our problems as they occur to us. And so I like to think about what is our problem. Now, before we come to AA, we were told about that all the time. How many of you remember, what was their favorite thing that people would point at us? You know what your problem is? You're a lazy son of a... You know what your problem is? And we were being told all the time what our problem was. When we came to AA, they tell us again. And I'm going to get to that in a minute. But where did they get this? Where did they get this? This is what your problem is. And I like to think that, you know, what is alcoholism? Maybe we should all agree on what it is. Because there's many definitions, the American Medical Association, all kinds of things. And I'm sure if we went around the room, everybody here would have a definition. Well, I can't drink safely. It's an obsession of this and a compulsion of the mind and an allergy of the boop and a beep. And they have all of those things that we could use as a definition. But here's where I like to go to establish, you see, because if you're going back to the basics, that is the basic, right, is an agreement of what the problem is. And if I like to get Carl Jung back involved when he sent Roland off. Now, the ending to that story, and Bob knows it very well, is that after AA had been around for a number of years, as a matter of fact, it was just about up into the 1960, Bill Wilson realized that he had never given Carl Jung the credit that he deserved, because he really had established the fundamentals of the surrender into AA with Roland, and so he wrote him a letter. And every so often they'll have this exchange of letters between Dr. Young and Bill Wilson in the Grapevine. And if you ever see him, you ought to read him. And Bill just wrote to tell him that maybe you don't remember, but Roland Hazard, you treated him, and as a result of what you told him, he went here, and then he came, and we started this organization. It's now all over the world. It's Alcoholics Anonymous, and you played the key starting role in getting this all done. And then Dr. Young wrote back, and it was right before he died. It was amazing that Bill happened to write him, I think 6 months later, he had died. And he wrote back, said, "Dear Mr. Wilson, no, I didn't know what happened to Roland. I'm so glad to hear that. That is absolutely wonderful. Thank you for sharing that." He said, "Now, when I was seeing Roland Hazard, it was so early in the century, I knew that spirituality was the answer to this, but it wasn't safe for me as a psychiatrist to talk about that because I would have been laughed out of my profession. But now, well, many psychiatrists are seeing that there are spiritual powers and that this is a important component of human beings." And he said, "This is what I felt about alcoholics back then." And he went on to describe the situation of being an alcoholic as having a thirst for something beyond ourselves. And the implication is that alcoholics have an extraordinary longing for God. They all sense that something's missing in their lives, and they are constantly aware of this emptiness, and they search for something to fill this, not knowing what it is. This is called misdiagnosis. We think it's money or sex or power or whatever it is, and we find out what it is through the process of elimination. Money doesn't fix it. This doesn't fix it. This doesn't fix it. We show up at this hokey-pokey program that says, "Oh, we know how to fix that thing. Do you know that thing inside of you? You know that thing? That's because you're too far away from God." "Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah." And then, lo and behold, that does fix it. Now, there is the core of the problem. So we always have to remember that no matter what we're diagnosing as our problem today, we're misdiagnosing. This is the core problem. So when we go into the big book, and what does it say our dilemma is? Lack of power. Now, do we always diagnose it that way? "Oh, I just got fired. My kid ran away. I don't know where the heck he is. Oh, my God, what are these feelings that I'm having? It's hard to go. This is lack of power." You follow what I'm saying? Because our mind just is quickly interpreting and going, "Oh, no, I need more money, and I have to go find my son, and I have to do that. That's why I am so upset." No, that is not why you're upset. My friend Hal Marley says, misery is optional. So if we are troubled, it's because we have a circumstance which is neutral that is bothering us. That's the problem, not the circumstance. See, the guy next door has the same circumstance, but his spiritual condition is such that it's not troubling him. It is just a circumstance. "Oh, I lost my car. Oh, I'll find it tomorrow." You know, you see what I'm saying? It's not a major event. He just, "Well, I'll notify the police." And the guy over here is loose. He can hardly breathe. My car's coming. They both have the same circumstance. This guy is not being troubled by it. This guy is being troubled by the circumstance. What's his problem? Lack of power. If you will go, the power doesn't make you find your car. The power gets you undisturbed. And the problem wasn't the car missing. The problem was that it bothered you that it was missing. You see the difference? It is a very core issue. And so as we go, even in the beginning, of course, we can't even conceptualize this. I'm sure there's people sitting out here now going, "What? What did he say?"
But you can't have a life without without circumstantial issues and problems.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unavailable. If we think the solution is going to be that we're going to get to a point where we just aren't going to have problems.
No, it'll never happen. No, it never happened. But we have to. That's why we have friends. That's why we go to meetings. That's why we go in there and we just go, blah, 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 and then you just go, well, we have to surrender. We have to. We're going to get this, and we can get undisturbed again, and then move into the situations and resolve them on the other level. Now, this is brought out beautifully. It's my favorite thing to talk about in the fundamental nature of the problem. In the chapter of the agnostic, and I think I do this every time I talk, I go to those first two paragraphs in the chapter of the agnostic, and it says, okay, are you new? Let me explain spirituality to you. I'm going to explain. It's very simple. It's a real easy thing. It's not like religion where we tell you about a certain higher power who was born 4,000 years ago. This is our best guess of what he looked like, and this was over in India, and he left these messages, and blah, blah, blah. And so you believe what I'm saying, then trust this power, and you're going to be fine. We don't have an AA power. There's no such thing. So, and spirituality doesn't have a power. It has a path. It has a technique to get in touch, and then you can describe what this power is. So they lay it out. Now, so how do you get spiritual, then, if there's nothing to believe in? You know, see what I'm saying? How do you do this? Well, you go to the problem as it's laid out in that chapter. And it says very simply, and see if you can follow this. Now, if when you drink, you have little control over the amount you drink. Everybody. If when you stop, you can't stay stopped. Everybody. Then you're an alcoholic. Okay, so there it is. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Okay, now let me tell you what that means when you just said you're an alcoholic. If that's the case, you are suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience can conquer. And you go, what? I remember my sponsor talking to me, and he says, did you hear what I said? You're suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience. It's one of the rare illnesses in the American Medical Association that only a spiritual experience can conquer. And I said, Bill, I don't believe in spiritual experiences. Oh, you're screwed. I'm sorry. Well, what am I going to do? Why don't you change your mind? Become a former agnostic. Become a thot. And then I'm going, spiritual experience. What is that? You know, I'm going to believe in the power. What is that? And I had the same feeling Bob does. I don't want to get spiritual. They'll make me give all my crap away to the poor. What if it overtakes you and your Mother Teresa? And she doesn't go bowling or anything. And so I don't want that. You know, I don't want to become entirely spiritual, and I want to be partial. Whoa. So then the next paragraph confronts us. Okay, you're almost spiritual. You're almost there. It says, to be doomed an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. That's a Jack Benny punchline right there. That is a comedy line. Do you understand it? Okay, you're on the quiz program. You're called up. Okay, Mary, you got to choose one of these doors, door A or door B. Die an alcoholic death, live on a spiritual basis. And guess what? Wow. Whoa, 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 whoa. Is there another door? Oh. Doctor, how bad is this an alcoholic death? Oh, shit. Okay, I'll do the spiritual door. Why do we get spiritual? There's nowhere else to go. They made us a deal we couldn't refuse. We didn't believe in it. We believed that there had to be something behind that door or it's over. So AA doesn't try to prove the existence of a higher power, but it sure convinces you of the need for one. And when you accept to your core gut that you need a higher power, you're 95% there. That's what the way I feel. The game is almost over. We just have the other 11 steps. but that's hardly anything. The steps are very easy. It's debating whether you're going to do them that is the hard part. How long does it take to do a fourth step? Oh, 4 years and 3 hours. 4 years of delaying and 3 hours of doing it. But if we're desperately have to get through it all, these things go bing, 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 bing. You can just go through because we're eager to get there. Why are we eager to get there? Are we convinced there's a pot of gold at the end? No. We're convinced that what will happen if we don't do it. And then when we get there, we go, oh, my God, I had no idea I was going to get this jackpot. And then when we tell our stories, it doesn't sound like that. We go, well, I came in, I saw this beautiful spiritual program, and I just went for it. And then your sponsor goes, yeah, with my hands around your neck choking you, you eagerly sought the spiritual program. So what I'm just covering there is don't misdiagnose anything. The last thing I'll turn back to Bob is I don't think I've missed more than 4 days without going to a meeting. And I'll tell you why. I don't want to ever do that. Because I've heard stories about guys with gals with solid, solid programs. And they moved. And when they first moved, there was a screw-up and the house heating system wasn't working and this thing and their job sent them over here. And then they got sick. And through no real deliberate action on their part, they went maybe a month without meetings. And here comes the tricky part. And they felt even better than when they were going to meetings. Ladies and gentlemen, I could not handle that. You put that in my computer, that I feel better after a month without meetings than I did with 25 years with meetings, I would not know how to handle that. Where do you file that? You see what I'm saying? Wow, maybe I overreacted.
You were pretty young.
Yeah, I was young, you know. Maybe in 25 years they've taken the impurities out of booze that hurts you. And maybe I didn't need those meetings all the time. Maybe I was brainwashed. Maybe I'm doing great. I can't believe that. I don't know how to handle that. So I never want to have that situation. So I'm just going to keep going and going so that I never have to deal with that. Okay. Enough out of me. Back to you.
The problem is that you say things so well, it doesn't need anything added to it. Think of that. I mean, think of how well he just, you know, went back to something that I have read 3 or 4 times in the last 3 or 4 months. But drew it to my attention in a stronger way than it was when I read it. And again, that's the nature of a spiritual book, is that when you really bring your attention to it, it is new. I mean, I think most of us heard that new, not like, you know, the first 2 paragraphs of the chapter to the agnostic. And isn't that, I mean, there is nothing in our society that would support what Sandy said. I mean, there's not much. I mean, the other thing is what you need is, you know, younger women, faster horses, and more money, or whatever that song was. You know, I mean, that's what you need. That's where your answer is. There's a book I was reading by Eckhart Tolle called The Power of Now. One of the distinctions he makes is the difference between happiness. He says happiness is a condition that is based on your perception that circumstances are okay. So most of us are thinking that, what do you want? I want to be happy. Okay, but peace and joy are not conditioned upon circumstances being okay. You can have peace and joy and have trouble. Okay, most of us identify the trouble with ourselves. We think we're the problem, that something's wrong with my life, not my life circumstances. And it's really tough to change your life. You know, it isn't so tough to get on a budget. but it's tough to change who you think you are. And I think that many of us have these distinctions collapsed. And what we're trying to do is kind of change our essential selves. But Sandy, part of what Sandy was saying is when you access the power, the problems just become circumstances. You are now able to be in front of those circumstances. I, for the longest time, had an issue of being angry and sometimes occasionally violent with my middle boy. He was just a pain in the ass. He was just a challenge to me. And it wasn't like there weren't issues. You know, he would occasionally get arrested or get thrown out of school or something like that. And my attitude was, what are you going to do? I mean, what the heck are you going to do? I don't know what to do. And I was doing what my dad did with me. My wonderful, wonderful man, my father. But I was doing what my dad did with me. It wasn't working, but, it's a family thing. And and somewhere into the unworkability of that, I got the thought that Sandy talked about with his neighbor. If my brother was parenting my son, my brother would not be doing what I am doing. If there were 10 men who had my son as their son, only two of us would have struck him. Where is the problem? Okay. The problem is not in the circumstance. The problem is my reaction to the circumstance. Life is just full of circumstances. I'll tell you something else about circumstances and problems. That old thing about problems being opportunities. How is God going to get our attention if something wants to change? How is the universe going to get our attention if it wants to get the message to us? And the message is, it's not working. Okay. Pain. Or your spouse. Or your father. Or your son. It's going to come from the people in your life. Maybe your creditors. Maybe a cop. But depending upon how integrated your life is. That is the universe giving you evidence of the workability and unworkability of your life. And it is a signal to pay attention. And you can change, make decisions, start to do something different. And we take it as, why am I getting this message? Something's wrong. We panic when we do this. And I really think that what it is guideposts. You know when they say, what do I do to become enlightened? Chop wood and carry water. What it means is live your life. As you live your life, you will be presented with the material you need to become spiritually awake. As you live your life with your spouse, you will be presented with the unworkability of yourself in relationships. Or with your father, or with your mother, or with your son, or with your boss. When you live your life in long-term relationships, you will be presented with what needs to be dealt with for you to become spiritually awake. And then you bring it back into the process. You bring it back into our practice. And as Sandy says, once you start to believe that your resolution is in finding the power, the circumstances it isn't personal. That's the thing that is just so profound to me over a period of time. Your life isn't personal. It's almost like it's not about you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that sounds nuts, but I mean, there's a freedom in that. The biggest freedom I've been able to maintain in my access in my life, and I don't even know if this relates to what the heck we're talking about, but I am a reactor, that spring-loaded 60 miles an hour head first type thing. I would get a thought and I would react, and the thought, when I would have it, would be printed on my eyeball. It is your reality. There is no other place to look. Okay? So I would think, what else can you do? I get it and I'd act on it. Okay? After a period of time, as you start to access, the first three steps, you start to rely on the God of your understanding. When you start to get out of your way and you start to realize that your thoughts are not reality, there's something wrong with the pattern. I mean, one of the great conversations we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is you have to have a healthy questioning of your own thinking. Not a neurotic questioning, but a healthy questioning of what goes through your mind. It is, our thinkers are not, always in tune. And so when you have that thought, I now have a space between my thought and when I act. I have a choice. I think I've always had that choice, but it didn't appear to me that I had that space nor that choice. So I get, and at 37 years of sobriety, I get the same thought when I'm angry. I might have a thought to strike someone. But I look at that today and I think, wow, I haven't had that thought in 2 months. Where the heck did that come from? I haven't had that thought in a year and a half. Where the hell did that come from? I am not my thought. I'm no longer a monkey on a string. I'm not a jukebox. You can put a coin in me and push B5. I don't have to play B5. I used to have to play it. You put me in front of the circumstance, we're going to dance, baby. You want to dance? We'll dance. Okay? But now you put the coin in, you push the button, and I get to choose. That is like being let out of jail. Without any circumstance in my life being changed, I get to be at peace. In the circumstances, I get to be untroubled, as our book talks about. That is the priority. And therein lies, there is a significant part of the practice and solution.
Good job, buddy. We're at the break.